You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Gray. Today's guest is Sidney Kirkpatrick. Sidney Kirkpatrick is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and best-selling author. His book, Edgar Cayce, An American Prophet, is considered the definitive biography of Edgar Cayce. No other author was given such complete access to Edgar Cayce's correspondence, traveled as widely to research the subject, or uncovered such a wealth of new material on the man regarded as the father of the New Age movement. His critically acclaimed nonfiction books include The Revenge of Thomas Eakins and Hitler's Holy Relics. Biographical profiles of Kirkpatrick have appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, and The New Yorker. He is a key speaker at the 80th anniversary ARE Members Congress, honoring the past, celebrating today, creating the future, in Virginia Beach from June 19th to the 24th, 2011. To find out more, go to edgarcayce.org, click on events, and then click on conferences. To find out more about Sidney Kirkpatrick, go to sidneykirkpatrick.com. That's SIDNEYKIRKPATRICK.com. Well, thanks for coming on the show today.
My great pleasure, Art.
How did you learn about Edgar Cayce?
I guess I was dragged kicking and screaming into the work. And that's really not an exaggeration. I really didn't know much, if anything, about Edgar Cayce, except from my children's school administrator in Pasadena, California. And she knew I was a writer of some note and had written several biographies, mostly sort of true crime journalism kinds of material. And she knew I was out searching for another subject for a book, and she kept talking about Edgar Cayce. It just drove me crazy with it. Kept sticking Venture Inward magazines into the mail slot at school. Would accost me in the hall, eventually gave me a copy of the first biography, There's a River, which I promptly threw into the back seat of my Isuzu Trooper and promptly ignored. But she just kept after me, one thing after another, and just by synchronicity, I can use that word now in a way that I couldn't originally. But we were on the same flight, same plane to Washington, D.C. And, the conversation started up just where it had left off in Pasadena. Edgar Cayce, I wanted to just tell her that, these stories about this man had been embroidered, embellished over the years, and that, something which seemed to be too good to be true couldn't be true. And so we carried our running debate to Virginia Beach and into the ARE library, and I sat down there and I was going to find the reading which would show Nancy the error of her ways and point out the mistakes, and I couldn't find them. And I just kept at it, and I kept at it, and I had envisioned as being a an hour and a half, 2 hour job in the Edgar Cayce Library, turned out to be 7 years.
Wow. So then you were really a skeptic when you approached this.
Well, I was I was aware of people like Edgar Cayce, though, when I say like Edgar Cayce, I don't really think there is anyone truly like Edgar Cayce, so certainly in Americans, so certainly not in the last century. But, I had great respect for Nancy, whom I actually later married and been partners with. And I thought she was, well-meaning and everything. But I just felt like, if you really studied this work, it wouldn't stand up under scrutiny. Because that's the background I was coming from. I mean, I had written you know, I'd written journalism, investigative reporting, and it drove me crazy, you know, as I started getting into the work. Certainly the first thing that struck you is the sheer volume of readings. You know, we're not talking 50, 100, 500, but, you know, 14,000 plus readings. Think of it, and each one is different. I mean, think of it like a Las Vegas stage act. I mean, imagine trying to come up with a different act every day, twice a day, for 45 years. So you had the volume, and then, of course, you have the specificity. You know, names, dates, body parts, blood type, blood temperature, body temperature. These aren't sort of the vague, ambiguous terms that one often associates with, you know, psychic readings. These were hard facts. These things easily, things that could be verified. And finally, I think it was the consistency of the readings. It was the same voice, the same message in many different variations kept coming through. What Edgar Cayce said in 1918 was consistent with what he was saying in 1944. And to be consistent over that many years, over having conducted so many readings, it was just difficult, impossible to explain. And of course, once you make that transition, once you make the leap from asking yourself, well, did he really do this? Because the evidence is overwhelming, he did. Once you make that leap and you ask yourself, well, how did he do it? Then you've opened the Pandora's box. And for me, it was, I didn't look back. And what I had envisioned as a relatively short biography, you know, something that might take a year and a half, 2 years. At the 3 year mark, when my editor started calling me from New York and saying, you know, where the hell are you? What are you doing? And I said, I'm only in the Akashic Records, and he thought I was talking about some library. Of course, it's true. It is a library, but it expanded, and I was very fortunate. It was a blessing, really, to have that opportunity because I had the time and the money. You know, got a rather significant advance from my publishers. Did have a track record, and essentially, you know, what we did is Nancy and I bought a motorhome and outfitted it with a computer and file cabinets, maps, took off across the country, stopping in virtually retracing Edgar Cayce's life from his very early childhood through the Alabama years, in Dayton, visiting everyone we could find who was still alive and who'd had readings. Really starting from scratch. One of the great opportunities we had, and it was a very rare thing. It was just really a question of timing. Was having a list, having access to a list of who had actually had the readings for a myriad of very good reasons. You know, patient, doctor confidentiality, that kind of thing. When Cayce was giving the readings, they didn't release the names of who'd had the readings. I mean, you know, because these are personal medical matters very often.
Mm-hmm.
But enough people had passed on, you know, by the time that I got to the readings that, that this information was made available to me to do my research. And once you actually put names to those readings, you know, anyone who studies the work knows the numbers, but once you actually put the names in the human flesh, people, onto those readings, you get a much richer appreciation of how important those readings were. Certainly, the first thing you would see is A, how many important people had readings. I mean, it was just we're talking the presidents of major corporations. You know, Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. You're talking about presidential candidates, Hollywood film actresses. You know, important physicians. Hmm. But when you get beyond the famous people, which you know, of course we did, you start realizing that it's the non-notables that become important. When you realize that, say, you know, I'm just picking this out of a hat, you know, 439, Lamar Jones is a tombstone cutter.
We'll be right back with more with Sidney Kirkpatrick on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Sidney Kirkpatrick.
439, Lamar Jones is a tombstone cutter. And if you just see the first reading where he comes in and he's asking for, what would be a good inscription, you might just pass over that reading and say, oh, well, that's not all that interesting. But when you realize that it's for Lamar Jones as a tombstone cutter, you realize, oh, well, you know, he's asking for a particular tombstone. And then you look into it a little deeper and you realize Lamar Jones's wife has just died. Oh, well, you know, this is for her tombstone. And then you get into it a little deeper and you realize that Lamar Jones and his wife are godparents to the Cayce children, Edgar's best fishing buddy. All of a sudden, the material that comes through has a vibrancy, a relevancy that you didn't initially see. It became a real revelation to me. What we did on the inside panel of this motorhome was to start putting down names of people we found who'd had readings. And because we had the computer database with which to correlate readings by, you know, when they were given, where they were given, we started being able to build these, they almost look like Christmas trees, like genealogical family trees, except it wasn't, you know, Cayce family per se, but the greater work, the greater family's work. And you began to see, you know, as we did, when we stepped into that gorgeous church, that it's a gorgeous church in Selma, Alabama. If you're ever there, you've just got to step into it. Mm. We would go to the churches first because that's invariably where Cayce, who was a deacon, a devoted churchman, taught Bible study, is invariably involved in the churches wherever he lives. So if you go into the Selma church, you can actually go into the archive, you know, the church records there, and see Cayce's handwriting because he was a church secretary.
Wow.
And if you correlate that with this wonderful, fantastic resource we have available from the ARE, the database of all the readings, and you correlate the names you see in those church records in Selma, Alabama, with those readings, all of a sudden you see, hey, look at this. Cayce was a church secretary that night, and look who he was seated with across the table. This person had the next reading. They must have talked about that. And no, the reading was successful because their cousin down the road had another reading. And all of a sudden, you start seeing how the work grew, how it wasn't as we understand the mass media today, where the radio interview we're conducting right now, you know, may reach out to thousands of people. This was the work one at a time, very slowly built, And what was being created was a family. And I stress this all the time, and it's one of the topics I want to talk about at Congress because it's very easy to think of Edgar Cayce's work as that of Edgar Cayce alone. And I fell into this. I fell into this right the first time Nancy walked me into the ARE library. I said, my God, look at his work, Edgar Cayce's work. Because it really was, Edgar Cayce didn't do what he did alone. He needed someone to guide him into trance. He needed someone, a stenographer, to take down what was said. He needed physicians to, you know, examine and try to do those treatments. But most important, he needed someone who needed help, who wanted help, who came to him, who came to the source. The larger point I'm trying to make is that it's not Edgar Cayce's work. It's all our work. It's the family that he built up, and it's the Lamar Jones. It's the Tombstone Cutter. It's as well as it's Gloria Swanson. It was really only until Edgar Cayce gradually built a team of his own, a functioning team, a team where the readings could be had and could be accurately documented, where treatments could be recommended and studied, that the really work came into fruition.
I know you mentioned that you had access to the archives and the names. That's something. I think you might be the only person ever granted open access to all of the correspondence in the Cayce archives, including the names.
It was just a matter of great timing. If Nancy had pulled me into the ARE library, 2 years before, even 6 weeks before, it might not have happened. You needed all of these different things in place. You needed the beach, ARE, to compile that CD-ROM, because if it wasn't all on a computer database, I'd be back where Jeff Stern was, 25, 30 years earlier. I'd be back where Tom Chagrou had been when, Gladys, the secretary, was hiding readings, underneath her bed. Or you had to go to someone like Hugh Lynn searching for a particular subject. And if he remembered what that subject was, or it happened to be on the index file, you could go find it. But this is instantaneously, I could access, do a Boolean search and access particular readings and then compare readings of the same subject. And that's where you make such wonderful, astonishing kinds of discoveries as so many of the people who study Cayce have found. For example, you'll find a treatment, and one would think, because of the internal consistency of the readings, that the treatment would remain the same from, 1923 to 1945, something that's, a treatment that's often recommended. But what you'll discover is that the treatment evolves, as does the reading. And the treatment evolves because new products come out on the market, new recipes, new ways of creating it, and the source seems to know that. There's one fantastic reading where the source almost says, hey, wait a minute, you can go out and get this product right now. It's now available in France. And actually, if you look at that reading and look at the pharmaceutical discovery, it was available, had only been available something like 48 hours before the reading was given. It just really blows you away.
Of course, I guess what you're talking about with the CD is rather than having all 14,000 readings, in a library, they're on a bunch of shelves. You had the CD that contained all the readings?
And it was really the first time. They just had a prototype out. It wasn't generally distributed, but I had it loaded into the, our computer in this motorhome, along with the names and numbers. And we literally just went across the country searching people out, and we found them. We found a cute story of a dentist, a man who'd become a dentist who had had readings and who was part of the KC Bible study group. You know, Edgar was constantly, whenever he had the opportunity, he'd get young people together, and he was always teaching the Bible. And he, you know, this was while Casey was a photographer, or at least the incident I'm, you know, referring to, and this octogenarian whom we were interviewing was just so excited about having an opportunity to talk about Edgar. You know, I'm just going to stop here. Wherever we went and found people who'd had readings.
So they were still living.
Loved. Oh, yeah. Oh,
wow.
There must be, we must have talked to 15, 20 people who've had readings. And what I found, I personally found so inspiring because, you know, as you know, I've written several biographies. So often, it's the unfortunate situation when somebody dies, you know, you might have their papers left behind, but the memories go very fast, you know, of that person, especially, you know, if they weren't endearing. Well, with Casey, it was just the exact opposite. You have what he left behind. You have the readings, but everyone we spoke to was just loved to talk about Casey and had their favorite Casey stories. And some of the times these were stories that were passed on, you know, from grandmother to mother, you know, to grandchild. And they loved these stories. This dentist, you know, was just beaming, just loved to talk about Edgar Casey, and was talking about playing cards with he and Gertrude and how wonderful it was to go up to their second floor, you know, photo studio and listen to Edgar Casey talk Bible. And Edgar Casey was a photographer at that point, and he had taken the church photograph, the church annual photograph. And the dentist was talking about how excited he was because Casey had mounted his camera on this specially built tripod he was experimenting with, and so that he could stay close enough to the congregation who was all standing out in front of the church on the lawn, but not so far away that you would lose the distinguishing, so you could actually see faces. But in order to get everybody in, he had to pan his camera from the left side to the right side. And, the guy we were talking to him disappeared into his bedroom and came out about 10 minutes later with his dusty old photograph in a frame showing me the portrait that Casey had taken. And this kid, as a young boy, was just so excited because he was standing on one side of the photograph before the pan, and then he ran around to the other side to get to, so he appears in this photograph twice.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. Let's continue our conversation with Sidney Kirkpatrick.
This kid, as a young boy, was just so excited because he was standing on one side of the photograph before the pan, and then he ran around to the other side to get to, so he appears in this photograph twice.
But,
I mean, it's just a silly thing, but it was, you know, meaningful for him, and it was just so exciting to see how these people loved Edgar and his family, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just the readings, it wasn't what came through in trance, it was this human being. They really loved this man, and it came through with almost everyone we spoke to.
I was going to ask you about that, about your research. I guess some of it focused on Edgar Casey's personal family life.
It was difficult to separate it, and I think everyone who starts getting into the readings, you know, once you make the transition away from the numbers to the human element of this, it really comes alive, and it becomes relevant in some ways, in some very important ways. It becomes relevant in your own life. It's an easier picture window into the lives of the people Edgar Casey touched and how he touched them, and believe me, he touched them. He changed lives. And it was very moving. You know, and for me, who had come in as a skeptic, What a ride. Nancy, who's been a devoted Casey person since she was in high school, lived with this in the material for years and years. So I think she often, sat back and sort of gagging to see me, waking up to all of this. A fun example on this trip was when we pulled into Anniston, Alabama, and we were in the motorhome, and I think we came in at like 2:30 in the morning, and just pulled in into a park and just turned off the key, turned off the ignition, went right to sleep, thinking we're going to wake up late. And then around 6:30 in the morning, there's this banging, almost a shuddering on the side of this motorhome, and just shocked me out of bed. From California, thought it was like an earthquake or something, and just ran out of the motorhome, and I was just in my little shorts, and there was this thin little kid, tall, bouncing a basketball off the back of the roof of the RV. I'm like, what the hell? What are you doing? And the kid looked at me like he was really stunned. Like, oh, I didn't think anybody was in there. I don't know what he was thinking, but it just shocked me. And he went running off, and Nancy and I were up and awake, no sleep, but we were up. And so we decided, well, we'll just tool on in the town and look for a place to eat. And we pulled in this little diner, and essentially a farming community. So these people are up early. 6:30 is nothing. The place was packed, and we're sitting there at the counter, ready to order, and this old fogey. I don't mean this disrespectfully, but he just looked like an old fogey. Came wandering out of the men's room, gesticulating with his hands, mumbling about Edgar Casey. My mouth hit the counter. It's like what's going on? And of course we approached him, and he was rehearsing for a Toastmasters speech he was giving at noon that day on Edgar Casey.
Wow.
He how Toastmasters work. You learn public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a Rotarian type of group, and it was his turn to do a speech, and his great aunt had readings, and he knew about it. It was a subject of interest, so he researched Edgar Casey in Anniston, Alabama, using his great aunt as a sort of vehicle, and he was going to give this talk, and he had done our research for us. Here he was. And if we hadn't been shaken out of the motorhome, 45 minutes before, we wouldn't have been there. And, chances of hooking up with him. But it was one of those things. It was like the universe sort of just opened the door. And we were there. And it came as a revelation to me. It didn't come as a revelation to Nancy, because she long ago accepted things like that. As I said, synchronicity just wasn't in my vocabulary, but very soon afterward was.
Oh, yes. I've heard that you were actually locked in the vault at the ARE for a night. Do you have any stories to share about that?
Jeanette Thomas, who was the vault keeper, the gatekeeper for decades. I think she suspected how skeptical about all of this I was, we were working very late one night, I swear it, I think she locked me in on, locked us in on purpose.
Oh, it wasn't just you.
No. Nancy and I worked on this together. Full credit goes to Nancy here. We work as a team. We were working in there, going through the vault, because not all of the correspondence got put into the CD-ROM, or it would be just overwhelming. I mean, you think of 14,000 readings, and any given reading itself may be anywhere from, 5 to 40 pages, and then the supplemental correspondence, you have thousands and thousands of pages.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have trouble reading your way from one end of the vault to the other. I mean, it would take about 3 years. But anyway, we were in there studying, and I don't know whether Jeanette Thomas thought I was ready to bolt, but she locked us in there, and came back, opened up the next morning, and what a night! It was just an exciting opportunity. I feel very, very blessed. I think, both Nancy and I do. I feel like, I've gone on and written, I'm on my eighth book now, on all different subjects.
Mm-hmm.
But I view my life, before Edgar Cayce and after Edgar Cayce. I mean, that's the impact that it really had on me. It's affected, how I treat my children, my daily morning routine, lemon water in the morning, KC exercises, diet. I mean, almost in any way you can think. And even though KC's name, doesn't appear in the books that I've subsequently written, if you look carefully, you read between the lines, it's there. It's affected the approach I take, to studying someone's life, is that studying by a writer's technique. You ask yourself, what would it have been like to be married to someone like Edgar Cayce, to be his child, to be his secretary. You in approaching a new subject, one of my big books after that was on the artist Thomas Aikens, a Philadelphia portrait painter, who was a very controversial figure. But going into that book, one of the first questions I asked myself, it's not in the text, asked myself, what was this soul drawn to? Why this particular incarnation on Earth? Why the particular circumstances? Who were his parents? We know from the Cayce readings that it's the soul chooses the family situation. It's the soul who chooses the parents. You try telling our teenage daughter that.
Interesting. Mm.
But that's the truth of it. And so if you look at, if you look at your own life, and as you study the lives of others, you start looking for purpose. What is this purpose? Why did this soul come? What was he or she trying to accomplish? And more important, echoing back to what I said earlier about the work being a team effort, who were their teammates? Who were their fellow team members? Souls incarnate together into teams, very often into the same families. They're continuing work which was started generations, lifetimes ago. And once you see this and try to put it into perspective, it's a lot easier to understand someone's life.
We'll be right back with more with Sidney Kirkpatrick on Reflections. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Sidney Kirkpatrick. The last time you were at the ARE, I think it was the last time, you spoke about a child who had readings by Mr. Cayce. She was called the Little Prophetess and was able to get prophetic readings and heal people as a child. Can you share some of that story with our listeners?
Yeah, Faith Harding. I urge everyone, go out and look at those readings because they're quite extraordinary. Faith Harding was the request came through from some friends Cayce had in Manhattan. It's a family he often stayed with when and he and Gertrude were in the city. And they had heard stories about a young child, a five-year-old, in Trucksville, Pennsylvania. And the stories that they heard were quite extraordinary. A young child who was prophesying almost out of the Bible, who could fall into a kind of reverie, and literally prophesy, almost, prophesy the future. And it had been, quite a stir in this little town. And so Casey was, a request came through to give a reading for this little child, whom he had not met and whom he knew nothing about. If you select, say, the 10 most extraordinary, strangest readings, unusual readings, compelling, powerful, it's difficult to quantify this, but if you were to pick the 10 most powerful readings, Faith Harding had two of them. And, it was not only important by the information that comes through, but how it came through. Very, very rarely, I would say, I'd have to count it, but certainly there's only 7-8 times in any of the readings when who or what comes through Edgar Casey actually stops and identifies himself. I mean, there's often suggestions of who or what the source is, but it's a mystery. On some very rare occasions, who or what stops and introduces themselves at the beginning of a reading. And in this case, it was accompanied by all kinds of very bizarre manifestations. There were three or four people in the room, all of whose stories about what happened are consistent. You have Mildred Davis, the stenographer, who was taking it down, and you also have, Gladys Davis, the stenographer, and you had her cousin,
yes.
Mildred Davis, who was in town visiting and whose task was to write down any unusual things that happened during a reading. And you look at her notes, her stenographic notes, and you get page after page after page of virtually nothing. I mean, you have just blank pages. So Casey shed a tear. His hand was twitching. He seemed to jerk when he came in or out of a trance. But on this date with Faith Harding, it just filled pages. What first happened was the windows started rattling. You've got to realize, Casey had been giving readings for 42, 43 years at this point. It's a very routine thing. I mean, it's just something, it's 9:45 rolls around, Edgar's out in the garden pulling weeds, and look at the time. Time to go into the reading. So he'll put down his hoe and go in. Gertrude could be in doing the dishes. Hugh Lynn, I don't know what Hugh Lynn was up to, but, it was, time to do a reading, and he'd go in, and it would be a very routine thing. It went like clockwork. Only this time, it didn't go like clockwork. It was like a wind blew into the room, even though the windows were closed. Papers, flew off Gladys's desk. She actually made a notation of that because she was sort of pissed off because all her typing that morning was now all out of order, and she had to put it all back together. Windows were rattling. Strange things. And then, perhaps stranger still, everyone in the room started crying. Nothing had been said, nothing to trigger it, at least nothing verbally. It was as if a sort of spontaneous kind of combustion, tears. Everyone started crying, including Edgar Casey, who was in trance. Now, you can say, rattling windows, mysterious wind, tears. look at it from a skeptic's, point of view, and you know, you've got a lot of room for, this has got to be exaggerated. But if you look at you go to the original stenographic notes in the vault, and you look at Gladys Davis's, shorthand, pad, you can see teardrops, dried teardrops.
Wow.
Same with Mildred Davis. So one gets a sense that, this was a prelude to something very special, and it was. I'm not going to quote this off the top of my head, but the voice that came through was significantly different in tone than Casey's usual readings. And the voice that came through was, hark. We have before you the archangel. Now, here, whoever was coming through was actually identified, the archangel, Michael.
Hmm.
And to paraphrase, the first reading was you have before you a very special child, born with very special gifts, gifts far beyond those of Edgar Casey himself. A very special female energy, which was represented by this, 5-year-old girl in Truxville, Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
So of course, Edgar and Gertrude, they all wanted to know about this girl, find out. So they sent word out, and sure enough, stories started, filtering back to them. It's far hard to say what was true and what wasn't, because some of the stories are quite extraordinary. It was a story of this little girl wandering out of her house across the street into an apple orchard, and the gardener in this orchard had a son with polio, and he would carry the child and sit him under one of the apple trees in the shade while the father did the work. And, little Faith had wandered out and sat with him for, however long. And, the child got up and walked home for the first time. So there was a lot of buzz. There was a lot of excitement about the little girl. So much so that a reporter from the local newspaper, by and large, quit his job and pitched a tent in their backyard just so he could be there taking down the things she said. And because of his work, like Gladys Davis's, we've got a very good record of the things she said. And it is quite extraordinary, a gift very much, if not greater than Casey himself.
Are these in a book or where other people can read them?
What I've told you, there's a whole section in our biography, Edgar Casey, an American Prophet.
Ah.
And at Congress, I'll bring some of the readings, some of her readings, Faith's readings, because, the skeptic that I was, rattling windows, spontaneous tears, I wasn't ready to buy that at all. Plus, I wanted to, I wanted to see who this woman was, see if she was still alive. She'd been a little child. When Casey gave the reading, and there was a huge mystery about what happened to her, because several generations of researchers had gone off looking. Is a little different in my case, because as an investigative journalist, I did that for a living, finding people. And Nancy and I were in the motorhome, and so Faith was on our list with 30 or 40 other people to look up and find, and we did. And her story is quite extraordinary. She's subsequently become good friends of ours, and has surreptitiously been down on the beach a couple times and in the vault looking at her own readings.
Wow.
I we don't like we really don't want to identify much about her, only because it's unfair, you know, to have, you know, Casey fans, people, you know, wanting to drop in, you know, who would naturally want to drop in. It's her own decision, and we're hoping that, you know, next year she'll come and join us on stage at the beach, along with several other people at readings. What an exciting venue that would be! You know,
oh, yes.
get you know, because they're out there. That's wonderful. The David Kahn children. David Kahn, of course, was a great friend of Edgar Casey's, who did a lot of the oil exploration with him, and was just devoted. And his children had readings in New Casey. You know, the people are out there, it'll be exciting to bring them to the forefront.
Oh, yes.
Still have them.
Oh, yes. And also maybe record them and their statements. That would be great.
Yeah, well, Nancy and I have been doing that, and eventually I'm sure those will go into the library. But it's, you know, you have to be careful not to invade someone's privacy. It's important to record these things and make sure they're protected and maintained for, you know, future research.
Oh, yes. Even if they put a time limit and say you can't reveal this for 50 years, that's fine.
Exactly.
You know, as long as it's recorded, there's something for the archives.
And we've been doing that. We must have, you know, 15, 20 hours of, maybe not that much, but we've got a lot of good,
a lot of
material we've been sequestering aside.
Well, thank you. And we're actually about out of time. Do you have a website where people can find out more?
Yeah, Edgar Casey Books, or just go, you know, SidneyKirkpatrick.com, SidneyKirkpatrick.com. You can even email me through that. And I look forward very much to coming to Congress this year. You know, I haven't been out as visible as I was a few years ago, essentially by choice. We've been sort of working more behind the scenes, putting a lot of really interesting projects together that are almost there, including a Casey movie. You know, we've been talking to Hollywood, and just all very excited about it. And so we'll have plenty of interesting news to share down in Congress.
Wow. Well, thank you for talking to us about all this stuff and for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yes. That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to Sidney Kirkpatrick for talking to us. You can find out more by going to SidneyKirkpatrick.com. That's SidneyKirkpatrick.com. Today, you are only able to hear part of my interview with Sidney Kirkpatrick. If you want to hear the whole interview, go to edgarcasey.org/radio and look for the podcast link, which will contain the whole interview and will be uploaded next month. Just click on past shows. You can also find his book, Edgar Casey, An American Prophet, at the ARE Catalog at arecatalog.com. That's also where you can find a version of the disc that we talked about today during the interview, a predecessor of which Mr. Kirkpatrick used to do a lot of his research. Just type in Readings DVD into the search box at arecatalog.com. To find out more about the conference where Mr. Kirkpatrick will be speaking, the ARE Members Congress, Honoring the Past, Celebrating Today, Creating the Future, in Virginia Beach from June 19th to the 24th, go to edgarcasey.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. Thanks also to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey.